Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event. Able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
I will say the guest that I definitely want to get next is Frank Cho, but he hasn't answered any of my emails yet, but he has become my new hero.
Okay. You'll have to explain that one to me. I don't get that one. I don't know that reference.
He keeps doing sketch covers of different Marvel characters in provocative poses, or he did one recently of Spider-Gwen getting shot in the head. Yeah, so
so he can draw that, but they can't draw Deadpool, you know, with the sword and Stan Lee.
Yes.
Okay. So as long as the object is hot.
Oh no. See, it's not. These aren't official covers. These are things he's just doing at cons.
Right. Oh, okay. He gets people off on the internet.
Right. Yes.
Well, that's easy. It's like trolling with steak. I
mean, yes, exactly.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
You ready to start, John?
Yeah.
Right. Hey, everyone. You're listening to Superhero Speak, and I'm your host, Dave.
And John.
And this week, boys and girls, we have a guest with us. Most of you are going to know him from his comic that he's done with IDW. He is the creative mind behind God Hates Astronauts, and we're going to talk about that. We're going to hit on his new project coming up, Blast Furnace. So, of course, everyone, I'm talking about Ryan Brown. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing just fine. How are you?
I'm doing good. How's the weather out there in Chicago?
Hot and humid. Hot and humid and wonderful. is your podcast really listened to by boys and girls? Is this a children's podcast?
No. That's just, it's kind of like, that's my impersonation of like Stan Lee. Kind of talking to the Marvel fans, you know, that's me talking to our fans. I'm just calling them boys and girls, you know.
Right.
Yes.
You should have just said yes, because we do a lot of censoring after we finish the podcast.
No.
I'll try and speak in small words with no foul length.
But that's what you normally do with comic people. Oh, no.
Oh, hey.
Oh, boy.
Oh.
You're off on a good start, John.
I know. Well, you know, I shouldn't have tried to finish the alcohol that I had brought with us to the other podcast, the live one. Yes, just to clear up something that a mistake that I almost made. You are Ryan Brown with an E.
Yes.
Not Ryan Brown without the E, who is like the creator of he worked on the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. He's the creator of April O'Neil and blah, blah, blah. You are a completely separate guy who does a lot of really different, really cool stuff, I guess, this Blast Furnace thing. And I was just going through the God Hates Astronauts, and, wow, that's hysterical, actually.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I am not in my mid-60s, so I am not the other Ryan Brown.
If so, you look really good for that age.
Hey, thanks, man. I appreciate it.
All right, so since John put his foot in his mouth, I was actually just going to ask as curiosity, have you ever gotten that at a con? Has anyone ever come up to you and thought you were the other Ryan Brown?
A couple times. It's usually someone that will roll up with a stack of comics
right,
looking for me to sign some Ninja Turtle stuff. I think it's happened two times. But those are the only mistaken identities. Sometimes people accidentally call me Riley Brown, who is an artist who works on Deadpool.
Okay.
So our names are very similar.
When they do that, do they look at you and think that you're like the guy who's watching the stall while the real guy's away? Or do they just look at you and say, here, sign this, not realizing that you are 40 years younger than me?
No, all times that it's happened, they've led with the, are you the Ryan Brown that worked on Ninja Turtles? And I wish I would lie and say yes. Yeah, I was working on it when I was like 12. It's a demanding schedule for a 12-year-old. I have to work after school.
Back when child labor laws were, you know, Not a thing.
Yeah. they would be kind of upset, I think, when they found out the truth if you signed their books.
Yeah,
maybe. So I guess backing up a little bit, as we always ask our guests, was comics something you always wanted to do? Was that the path you always wanted to go on, or?
I mean, I went to art school. I wanted to do comics, but then I went to art school to be a painter.
Mm-hmm.
And then after about a year of art school, about when I found out that David Mazzucchelli was an instructor at the school, I decided to shift it to illustration. And it wasn't until I took two semesters with Mazzucchelli, and that's what really started to inflame my love for storytelling, not just for illustrating and art. So ever since then, I've been increasingly more storytelling focused in my comics, rather than doing covers or, you know, spot illustrations or anything like that. So that's why Blast Furnace is much more about storytelling than it is about finished art. So it kind of itches that need for me to tell stories. And,
right.
And that's why I started. I'm not super gifted with the English language, but I became a writer in comics just out of my desire to tell stories. And then I just kind of fumbled my way through figuring out what the dialogue's going to be. That's kind of how I got to where I am.
Yeah, cool. No, the way you're talking just reminds me a lot of Steve Scott. And that's one of, he doesn't consider himself a comic book artist. He considers himself a visual storyteller, which I think is a better way to look at it, you know, especially when you work in that medium. You know, just instead of just, oh, I draw pretty pictures, I tell a story through my pictures. So I get what you're saying. I'm pretty sure, God Hates Astronauts isn't the first thing that you did, right? Like, did you actually work on TMNT? At some point?
The only thing I've done on it is a variant cover.
Okay.
I keep trying to get some work doing it, but all the openings keep being when I'm not available. So,
right.
Because that's actually one of my biggest influences growing up, and it's why all I do now is draw muscle people with animal heads. You know, basically my own version of Ninja Turtles at all times. Definitely, that's like a big inspirational thing for me, is Ninja Turtle stuff. My first professional gig was my first professional gig was working for Devil's Due Publishing back in the day, working on like Voltron and G.I. Joe Storm Shadow, and I worked on illustrating an original like 48-page book called The Haunted Caves. Which featured no caves.
Okay.
And it's kind of the worst put together comic ever made. I had to draw it in less than a month, and it was 48 pages. So I got about 28 pages in while having a full time job, and then they hired someone else to do like the middle pages. And it was a screenplay for a horror movie that some guy paid Devil's Due to turn into a comic book. And it's really awful and mean-spirited and dark and disturbing and truly terrible. So you find that one, that's a serious Ryan Brown diamond in the rough, so to speak. After I did that, then I did a book called Smoke and Mirrors for IDW. That was a comic that was co-written by one of the premier sleight of hand magicians in the entire world. And he put magic tricks into every single issue. So within the story, there were magic tricks built into the story. So a lot of like mental forces, you know, that would force you to pick a certain thing, even though you think you have free will, that kind of stuff, and some math games and puzzles that I worked into it. Which was really, really fun.
That's actually interesting because I haven't studied in years. When I was younger, I was really interested in magic, and I read a lot of different books. And I always thought the manipulation stuff had to do with tone and the way that you talk to the other person is how you guided them on the choices they make, you know. Or like when you're doing a card trick, there is a way to lead them into picking a certain card. I'm kind of curious how you do that in a comic book. I guess it's just by the words you use?
Somewhat. And by doing studies about people's psychology and what people tend to choose based on what cards are visible.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know too much about it because of, you know, John Armstrong, who co-wrote the book, he's the one that kind of educated me on the things that I need to be drawing and showed me how to draw them. And he would take photos that I would use for reference so that I would get it right.
Okay.
Yeah, I once saw John do a card force to a baby. Like, legitimately was doing a magic trick for a woman holding a baby and then said to the baby, pick a card, and then just kind of the baby picked the correct card. So it is pretty incredible what you can do with magic, or at least what John can do with magic. So we had a lot of stuff like that. You know, like one of the simplest ones that we did, it's a really, really old trick that people use, have done forever. And it basically, it says, pick a card on one page. And he's fanning five court cards, you know, king, queen, jack. And then on the next page, he fans out five court cards and says, your card is gone. The real trick to it, of course, is that every card is different. But they look similar enough that all you were doing was focusing on your own card, and your card is gone. So if you like actually analyze it and you flip back, you can see right through the trick. But it works. I mean, it works 99 out of 100 times. And we did that. And it was the simplest one, and we did it in the first issue. And when I would go to comic shows, it was just so fun to just show that to people. And I still show the trade to people, and it almost always works. So it's stuff like that, you know, when, you know, forcing people to pay attention to the thing you want them to pay attention to and not the thing that's actually important.
Yes. Now, and it's so funny. I'm just thinking of, this is probably going back 6-7 years ago. And I used to volunteer at a lot of different comic book conventions, and I was working at one, and it's near the end of the day, and I'd been working in Artist Alley, and, it was one of the first times I met Lee Weeks. Mm-hmm. And
he likes magic.
Oh, yeah. And he's like, oh, you've been working real hard today. Here, I want to do something for you. And he did a couple magic tricks. And you know, he's really good, actually. And and it's funny, you know. And it is a lot of stuff like that. It's just knowing the manipulation and how to get people to pick the right card and whatnot. So I encourage anyone listening to this podcast, if you see Lee Weeks at a comic book convention, just ask him if he has his cards with him, you know, and he loves to do it. He'll do it for hours. And I guess now they can ask you too.
Yeah. Well, I do it by showing them comics.
Oh, okay. All right. Sorry to put you on the spot. So, God Hates Astronauts was actually born out of the 24-hour challenge.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, for people who aren't familiar with what the 24-hour challenge is an artist is challenged to write a 24-page comic book in 24 hours. And, is that as hard as it sounds?
Yeah, it's awful. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, writing and drawing it in 24 hours is pretty awful. I've done it, I think, 5 times, and every time it ends in one time it ended in hallucinations for me. It's the only time in my life that I've ever really seen hallucinations, and I kept out of the corner of my eye seeing that there was a T-shirt floating in the air. Okay. It was really strange. Yeah. So not a very interesting hallucination. but like the level of focus that you need is so exhausting because you are constantly under the crunch of the clock. You know, the idea is to finish a page every single hour. And so, you know, you eat while you do it. Bathroom breaks are as fast as possible. And yeah, it's really tough. I'll never do it again. I'm too old for that shit now. I can't have it because it destroys you for several days.
Yeah.
It always does. And Yeah, so one of them I did was God Hates Astronauts. It basically just was a really loose version of the first issue. And I liked a lot of the jokes and ideas in it. So that's why I took them and used it as a rough draft and made it in the start of the story. And it's also what Blast Furnace is.
Oh, okay.
Blast Furnace is a book that I enjoy my output from a 24-hour comic a lot. And I think I make really fun comics. You know, the drawings aren't great, but the stories usually end up kind of working really well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like one of those things that I'm actually pretty good at doing is kind of improvising and thinking on my feet and seeing connections and story and characters. So Blast Furnace, I started it as I would only have an hour for each page, just like a 24-hour comic. And I wouldn't plan and I wouldn't think ahead, just like a 24-hour comic. But I did a page every day. And the idea was I was going to do it for a year. But I did it for 6 months and nobody read it. So stopped. But since then, it has built up quite a decent cult following. So when I finished God Hates Astronauts, in the most recent run for Image, I decided to go back to Blast Furnace and finish the final 6 months. So that's what I'm working on now. And the book is nearly complete.
Oh, cool. And,
yeah. And you have a Kickstarter for it too.
Yeah. Right? So, yeah. And so the Kickstarter is for, it's 262 pages of story. Which is 5 days a week for a year,
right?
Basically. And because a lot of people didn't read Blast Furnace because it was black and white, and the drawings are pretty simple. But the story and the ideas and the jokes, I think, are you know, just as solid as God Hates Astronauts. So for the Kickstarter, I've decided to color the entire thing. So it's 262 story pages in full color. And each one I spent an hour writing and drawing it, and then a half an hour at the most coloring the page.
Oh, okay, cool. So I guess it's along the same lines, like it's got the same kind of sarcastic humor and is it another satirical look at superheroes as, God Hates Astronauts has been, described?
No, it's, I mean, it's the same sense of humor, but it's largely crime. It's a lot of really serious crime scenarios featuring animals. is a lot of it. My humor is pretty simple in terms of how I make it work, and usually it is a really serious situation. But all the performers in it are totally ridiculous. Their attitudes are ridiculous. Their responses are ridiculous. They look ridiculous. And you can get a lot of like inherent funniness out of the fact that nobody has a sense of humor and nobody points out how weird all of this stuff is. So you can have, you know, an owl and a bear, fleeing from corrupt cops and, you know, like it's a really intense story, but at its heart, it's totally ridiculous. You know, just because of like the world that it's occurring in. So yeah, that's kind of what Blast Furnace is. It's a lot of crime stuff. It's a lot of allusions to things like Coen Brother movies. but yeah, and like 80s films and, nothing superhero in it. There's a touch of science fiction stuff. There's a scientist that builds robots. That builds robot businessmen that all join together to make one larger robot businessman. but beyond that, there's one character. My favorite character in the book is he's a Native American who he's got the head of a horse and the body of a man.
Right.
And his name is He Who Looks Like a Horse, but actually he's just a hideously deformed man. And so he's just a man. He just looks like a horse, but he's not a horse. And so it's funny because you can get so much humor out of people having to say his name all the time, which is extremely long and outrageous. So yeah, I like that guy a lot.
it's funny. It's definitely I would call that like absurdist humor on some level. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Just it's the situation is serious, but because of all the elements that make it up, it becomes absurd, and that's what makes it funny. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and it's important. It's important to me to not do cheap jokes. Mm-hmm. I really like to have a logic behind everything. It's not just what kind of weird thing can happen next. Isn't that funny how weird it is? Like, I like to have things that seem natural within the world that I'm making.
Right.
And hopefully not seem forced, because nothing's worse than forced silliness. I don't know what makes it so that you can read it and see the forcedness of the silliness. But when you can, I think it's pretty off-putting.
Right, right.
It must be one really strange world to have something like a panel with a smoking man-sized goose, I think.
Yes.
Being watched by a policeman with a flaming tie. And then when I mean flaming, I mean it's on fire. So I really have to read the rest of this.
Yeah, it's good stuff. It's dumb, it's easy, you know. There's a lot of emotions. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll...
it's better than Cats?
No, I don't think that's true.
Oh. Yeah. yes, so it's not... It's not Family Guy, where, they do some absurdist stuff, but then, like, they just do weird stuff for the sake of being weird, I think.
Yeah, and Family Guy does a lot of pulling you out of the story just to
make a joke, right?
Make a joke. It is. It's similar to Family Guy in the sense that I knew I had 262 pages to fill, and without a script of what was going to happen and an overall arc, I just let it go kind of freeform. It's very stream of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
It follows flashbacks within flashbacks within flashbacks within flashbacks. It kind of goes down many different rabbit holes of, you know, where I think it'd be funny to just continue the story in some bizarre tangent. So in that sense, there's a lot of jokes in it. There's a lot of pages to fill, kind of how Family Guy throws a million jokes at you. And if one out of five is good, then they seem to be happy about that.
Right. Right.
But yeah, so it's sort of, I would see a little bit of a comparison in terms of that.
Right, right. And that's the reason I brought it up, because when you're writing something that the way that you're writing it, it becomes very stream of consciousness. And I feel that a lot of the humor, especially in the early days of Family Guy, was just guys in a room talking, and this was their conversation, and that became an episode. So all the jokes they had in the succession that they said them in the room, boom, there we go. We got 24 minutes, we're done. Let's move on to the next one. Right. So yeah. I could see that easily becoming an issue when you're writing something in that style. Right. So
what? It, also on Wikipedia, you have to read the Wikipedia page, you know, like the first piece of research we do. But it said that you were also influenced by The Tick, and I can definitely see that,
yeah,
especially with the stream of consciousness stuff. But what did you like about The Tick, and how did that influence this for you?
The Tick has the same sort of sense of humor. The Tick doesn't have that edge of offensiveness that I sometimes can slightly push.
Well, you should have seen the TV show would have, but
yeah. Yeah, sure. But, even something like Chainsaw Vigilante in The Tick, you know, is not super offensive, even though he's running around with a chainsaw trying to cut people up. There's that sense of childhood joy in The Tick, and that also sense of absurdity, but within a logical world. Like, there's a logic to the world where are there all these superheroes, and I just love how desperately people are trying to do a good job of being a superhero, but they're kind of just, I don't know, either their powers are worthless or they're just kind of a schlub. You know, and I think, you know, superheroes are so easy to make fun of because at their core, superheroes should be silly and they should be fun. And somehow in the 80s, we took a terrible direction that now superheroes all have to be real people or have complex emotions and deal with real problems, which is fine for some stuff. But, the reality is Batman is a hilariously stupid character right? And
how do you?
Well, because he's dressed like a bat, right?
Right.
True.
He has all these gadgets that are all bat themed. Like, he's branded his entire crime fighting. He's this billionaire who spends, you know, billions, millions of dollars or whatever on incredible crime fighting equipment so that he can go and beat up muggers instead of, you know, actually investing his money in, you know, social reform, you know, mental health, you know, institutes and, you know, stuff to help the homeless and the poor. He just goes and beats up people who are stealing purses. which is just like, it's just ridiculous. That doesn't make any sense.
I think the last thing that Batman would ever put money into his mental health, because then he'd have to admit he has a problem.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Wouldn't that be sad
much more fun when he's goofing around and coming up with inventions and, you know, that miraculously solve the problem that he's going to have in that issue. You know, like, that's a lot more fun to me. Superman's a lot more fun when he's, you know, interacting with bizarre aliens and finding funny artifacts of Krypton rather than, like, dealing with the U.S. government or, you know, like, it seems very strange to me that superheroes have gotten so serious. Like the Civil War, you know, I know that was a while ago, but I mean, come on, man. People dressed up in these ridiculous costumes having these really intense debates, and it's just like, what? You got a big A on your forehead, you know? Like, you got blue plate mail and a red and white stripes, like, and little feathers on the side of your head. Like, it's ridiculous. It just doesn't make any sense when you make them real people. It just doesn't. And so feel like they're constantly fighting with that and constantly trying to make it make sense for real people to be doing this. Which, you know, in some instances, it's totally legit and it makes for great stories. But other times, if you just gave a normal person a normal superhero book that's happening today that's really deep within continuity or really deep within, you have to understand these characters and you have to totally buy in that, you know, this is really serious and this is really important, and you actually just step back and look at the visuals, everything that's happening is totally ridiculous. And that just seems so strange to me, that's kind of the way things have become. But I guess that's what sells, and that's what people expect at this point.
Right.
Well, it's kind of a wish fulfillment vision that people have bought into.
Well, you know? It's, I mean, one of the things, because you had said the 80s, and that is, you know, when this really started happening, it was... you know, you had The Watchmen come out and everyone loved it. And then, they had the, Dark Knight Returns, which sold really well and everyone loved it. And then The Killing Joke, and it's just like, and Death in a Family. So you had these big pivotal stories that happened in the 80s that were very serious stories. Mm-hmm. And the industry just latched onto it and said, okay, now everything's got to be ultra serious. And it's like, well, wait, what happened to fun?
Yeah. Yeah, it disappeared. Well, what happened to fun in the 80s was it went to indie books.
Right.
You know, that's where I've always felt like I'm making books that should have come out in the late 80s and, you know, from like slave labor or, you know, some sort of NEC or something. But yeah, I mean, it's just it is really, really strange the way everything's kind of occurred. And I think we're getting out of it. Right now, I think the creator-owned books are getting out of that level of seriousness at all times, or they're building more believable serious realities. You know, science fiction stuff that you know, happens on alien worlds, or you know, like, you have a book like Manhattan Projects, which is totally ludicrous and intentionally ludicrous.
Right.
And that's what makes that book so fun. So yeah, I mean, stuff that's happening in Image especially, I think is a really good place for, you know, making comics fun again. Like, I use a lot of onomatopoeia in my work, because that's part of the language of comics. And in the, like, mid-2000s and early 2000s when like the Ultimates was coming out, there was this big shift in a lot of comics that you don't have sound effects on the page, because yes. this is a movie, right? And we got to make this cinematic feeling, right? And these wide panels, and you know, and that's valid. It's a valid way of doing things, and you know, the Ultimates had some great moments. But if you don't have sound effects, like, that's part of the language of comics, and it really neuters what you can do. Like, it just seems really strange. Like, sound effects are information to help you play out the scene in your imagination better. So if someone's firing a gun and there's no sound effect, it just takes so much impact out of it in terms of what you're, you know, what you're, how you're completing the story in your mind. Right. So that's something that I've like always tried to force. And I've had to draw work for hire stuff that has no sound effects, and it just seems so flat to me.
Right. No, and I totally agree. Cause I mean, even Marvel, who did the Ultimates line, and said, and obviously it was Bendis, was like, no sound effects, are known for having very specific sound effects. The snicked for Wolverine's claws, thwip for Spider-Man's web. It's like, and like,
They've got
very specific sound effects that everyone knew as soon as they saw that written, what it meant. That, well, everyone that was in the comic books. And so, for them to then say, okay, no, we're not going to do it anymore. Now it's very serious. And it's a movie. It's like, yeah, I don't know. I kind of think, I wonder if the mentality came from, again, I'm going to use Batman, the Batman and Robin movie, because that was so, you know, panned by critics and everything. Sure. And it had sound effects in it. You know, they did the whoop sound when they got knocked over on the ice, you know, and they did, they had like, that was throughout the whole movie, the very, very much a throwback to the 66 Batman. And it was just like, you know, was it, oh, okay, we're afraid of ever being associated with that, so get rid of the sound effects. It's like, it doesn't work though.
Yeah, it doesn't. And comics don't have a soundtrack, so you you need that information, unless you're going to have it in some sort of narration. You know, and getting rid of thought balloons is the same idea, which doesn't make any sense. I mean, why do you care about sound effects and thought balloons when you have speech balloons and narration boxes? You still have to read words that are pointed at someone's mouth on this page, so it just doesn't make any sense. Why take that stuff away? You know, it's like there is no other storytelling medium where you don't get that information. It just happens in comics when they take out the sound effects. Like, you know, in a book, when you're reading, if you're reading a fight scene, they would elaborate on what is happening to give you a better idea of visualizing it. Right. And that's what sound effects would do in comics.
Right. Exactly. And you can read almost any novel, and if there's especially if it's a novel told from a particular character's point of view, they're going to have their thoughts written down in the book.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's the same thing as
part of storytelling frequently.
Right. And that's where the idea of thought bubbles came from. So now you're going to take it away because it's silly. Well, no,
that doesn't happen in movies. I mean, I don't know. People aren't drawings usually in movies either. Are you going to just do photo comics, or like, where do you draw the line?
Well, and that's one of the things too, when they did the adaption of The Dark Knight Returns, for the cartoon version that came out, what was it, 2 years ago? And one of the big things was, oh, we want to remove the narration, which they made it work, but it was still silly. It's like, that was such a big part of that comic book. And to take it out, they had to rework a lot of things for that movie to still make sense. You know, like, just leave it in. Now, we have a movie coming out next year, which is going to be the most gruesome and should be the silliest superhero movie ever, which is Deadpool. Mm-hmm. And if he's not breaking the fourth wall and they're not, like, doing something crazy with thought bubbles or, you know, hearing his thoughts, Deadpool fans are like, this doesn't work. You know,
right.
So then will they bring it back in comics if they get away with it on the big screen?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just really excited to not see Batman versus Superman. and for people to ask me if I've seen it, and for me to be dumbfounded why they'd even ask. That plays right into it, because that's the DC mandate. Is there is no humor in their superhero movies.
Right.
And Man of Steel was such a soulless piece of shit. Like, it really, it was so misguided, I can't even believe it.
How do you really feel about the movie, though? Oh.
Excuse me while I cry over here. I'll just, you know.
It was brutal. And I just don't.
Yeah.
If Zack Snyder continues to make these hyper violent misogynistic films that are completely soulless, like why I don't understand why anyone cares if Ben Affleck is Batman. Just don't go see it. It really doesn't matter. There's a bunch of comics that have great stories. You can read those.
Yes.
But anyways.
Well, yeah, and if that's anything new, it has to be independent if you want good stories.
Yes.
Yes, pretty much. Yeah.
You know, unless we get another crossover event with everyone. So, all right. So I'm gonna ask you a question, and you can not answer it if you want.
Okay.
Oh.
No. It's just okay. So when you do something that's absurdist humor or just being humorous, and you're doing a train of thought, I guess the question really is, do you do any self-censoring? Do you go back and edit yourself to say, oh, you know, I really shouldn't say that, or I really shouldn't put that in the book? Or have you gone, I'm just going to put it out as is, and have you gotten in trouble for stuff that maybe you've put in books?
I've never gotten in trouble for anything. Okay. I certainly make stuff that's not for everyone.
Right.
And, you know, and that's part of what I have to, you know, accept with what I'm doing, which is fine. You know, playing to a specific audience is a part of art. And, there's a lot of people that wouldn't even pick my book up, you know, just strictly based on the title.
Right.
You know, those who get it know that I'm having a lot of fun with it. And nothing is ever meant to be mean-spirited that I do. And I think that that's just kind of me following my instincts and what I like to do, you know, like it's just kind of a childlike kind of silliness. But dealing with, you know, lots of referential stuff to like very R-rated movies.
Right.
But, you know, at this point I've kind of learned to trust my instincts on it. I was pretty nervous when I was first making the book, before I really had much of a fan base, that it was just going to be taken the wrong way frequently. And especially doing a book with the title God Hates Astronauts, there's definitely been enough, you know, people that will say things to me at comic shows about the title who don't get it or are slightly put off by it, even though it doesn't really say much. It's kind of, you know, nonsense a little bit.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think if I had one regret is having the word God in my title, because it doesn't bother me at all, but it bothers every once in a while there's someone that's kind of off-put by it. Even though it's not like with any sort of loaded, you know, context to it, like it's
not—it's
really not saying anything. But I just think that people, you know, it's a parody on, you know, using God Hates Whatever, you know, which I think is a really bizarre, mean-spirited part of some people's beliefs.
Right.
But yeah, it's just really it's silly and absurdist, and if people don't have a sense of humor, they're probably not going to enjoy my book. You know, and I just have to be okay with that.
Oh, no. I mean, but the thing is, people can take anything like that and come up with their own conspiracy theory on why you named it that way.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, you know, I'm sure.
If you read the comic book backwards, it's the Satanic Verses, right?
Right.
The Illuminati came out and told you to name it that so that it would get people away from looking to God and clinging on to science or something like that, you know. Just,
and if that doesn't work, the aliens will.
I mean, just do a search on anything on the internet and you'll get 1,000 crazy people hits. So, I mean, because I can't imagine someone saying anything, because it is just a nonsensical term, like God hates astronauts. Like, I don't take anything from that, but I mean, I'm a normal person, so.
Right, well,
it fits the comic too. I think it fits the comic.
It's a very absurdist title. It goes along with what the comic is, right?
I mean, I've always thought of it as like a band name, you know, like a
good
name. Yeah. Like I like when you've got a band name that kind of gives you an idea of what the mood or the message behind the music is going to be, like, yes, then that's an amazing band name. So yeah, so it's more of that. It doesn't really tell you about the plot, but it tells you about the mood of it.
Right, right. So just do it like what a lot of bands do nowadays and just call it GHA. And
Yep. I do all the time. It's a lot quicker to type.
Well, there you go. Problem solved, everyone.
Right.
Don't worry about it. God loves everyone.
Yeah.
Or no one. I don't know what your philosophical bent is on that, but.
Or the spaghetti monster does, or whatever.
Yes. Whatever deity you do or don't believe in loves you or hates you.
Whatever you want. Whatever you feel is best.
Yes, whatever you feel is best.
But they probably still don't like astronauts.
Probably not.
So then can I ask where did the title come from? Like, did it?
You know, I don't really know. I did a drawing once of an angel because I like drawing wings. Mm-hmm. That's the only reason why I was drawing an angel. An angel kicking an astronaut in the face and his like helmet exploding in deep space. And okay. she was wearing a t-shirt that said God hates astronauts.
Okay.
And then I just kind of banked that as an idea for a book. And then when I was in college, I put out an anthology of short comics and I called it God Hates Astronauts because I liked that title. And then that drawing was in that anthology. And then when I was working on the, you know, what eventually became God Hates Astronauts, I was like, well, I've already used this title, but only like 100 people read that anthology, so I'll just use it again. So
there you go. Recycling.
That picture that you described, if that was an album cover, that album would sell 10 million copies.
Oh,
I'm telling
yeah.
you. Yeah. Without a doubt. I mean, that's, you know, definitely. And that's exactly what you're saying. It's a band name. So
right.
It's perfect. So you did the Kickstarter was successful. What is the plans moving forward for Blast Furnace? Like, do you have a date on when people will start seeing things?
Well, you know, it's been a webcomic for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I took down the webcomic and I've started posting color pages for people to read. But the book, the goal was, the Kickstarter ends September 23rd, and my goal was to have the book finished for September 23rd. It's going to be really close to that, and then send it to press, and it will get printed, and 6 weeks later, I'll have all these books to send out to all the backers. So,
okay.
You know, the true goal was that everyone, hopefully, even the international people, will get their books before Christmas. You know, domestic U.S. people and Canada people should hopefully have it in November, by the end of November, maybe. So that's the plan.
All right. And I'm just kind of curious with something like this. So you're doing it independently then, or you're not doing it through Image?
No, not through Image. No.
Okay. All right. So if people who didn't subscribe to the Kickstarter want a book, they have to find you at a convention, I guess, at this point?
Largely, yeah. I will have them on my Etsy store as well.
Okay.
But, you know, I don't know how many I'm going to actually be able to print because you have to house all those books.
Yes.
You know, you'd hate to print up, you know, thousands and thousands, and then it turns out people don't actually like it, and then I can't sell them at all. So,
right.
So, yeah. So with any kind of Kickstarter thing, like when I did God Hates Astronauts through Kickstarter and I did a hardcover, I sold out of books within a year, just selling them at shows and online. So I would assume that Blast Furnace, I hope Blast Furnace will last more than a year in print, because I don't ever want to reprint it because it's, I'd have to raise a ton of money all over again.
Right, right.
So yeah, I mean, really the best way to get it is through Kickstarter. That's when you'll get it. That's the fastest way to get it. That's the best way to get it. And if you back it through Kickstarter, you get a bunch of, we're working on stretch goals that come with it. And then, like digital, and you also get the digital version, which will only be available through the Kickstarter. So there's a lot of things that are only available, through the Kickstarter that. So if it sounds interesting, you have till the 23rd to actually, buy it, I guess.
Cool. All right. Well, this episode is going up tomorrow, so they still have time. So there you go.
Awesome.
All right. And so then that leads me to my next question then. You know, the internet obviously has changed so much for artists. You know, like musicians can just create music and put it up online. Comic book creators can just create an online comic and put it online for people to see. And then now you have things like Kickstarter, you know, that where you can back this. Now, I mean, is that how you look at it? Like, this is a great tool for independent artists to say, hey, I want to do a book. Let me throw it on Kickstarter and get it funded, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Kickstarter is a fantastic tool. It is still largely misunderstood with people that I find. It is not a donation and is not a charity. It is a pre-order system. You know, the core of Kickstarter is someone gives you money to get something. Whether that's, you know, a super low level for like a buck and you get a postcard, or it's you pay $25 and you get a book, you are paying money for, you know, the book that you would pay money for after it was printed. But you're giving me the money first so that I can afford to print it, and then you get your book a little bit later. So there's this, the economy within this is trust-based. So my backers trust me with the money ahead of time, and then I reward their trust by getting them a book as fast as possible. Of course, there's tons of Kickstarters that have failed to do that, but I've successfully fulfilled both of my first two Kickstarters within 3 months of it ending, and then that's the plan on Blast Furnace as well, because I want people to have faith in me that I'm going to make my books and that they're going to get something that they paid money for, which is the way it should be. That's how Kickstarter works. And that's how Kickstarter continues to work. But like, for example, I've already hit my goal. So something after it's hit its goal, because they think that I'm just getting rich on money, free money. but that's not the case at all. Every time someone buys a book, it costs me a book. It costs me, packaging. It costs me the shipping. And it costs me the fees to Kickstarter and Amazon. So, for every sale, there's more work for me to do and there's more cost for me. So when I hit 15,000, the first book that I sold over 15,000, that raised my cost over 15,000. So it kind of grows. The amount of money you need to sink into the project, from what you make on Kickstarter grows as you make more money on Kickstarter.
Right.
But there's, you know, it's very interesting. There's tons of people that are up in arms if they think that you are too successful, that you shouldn't be having a Kickstarter because you know, have access to publishers. But publishers take tons of money. You know, you deal with a publisher, they take a chunk. Then Diamond, who distributes the stores, takes a huge chunk. And then when you send, you know, when you sell things in a store, stores usually buy the books for 40 to 50% off cover price.
Right.
So when you look at the reality of it, if I did, like when I did God Hates Astronauts as a hardcover, you know, I sold 1,700 of them online. And then the first issue of the new Image series, I sold 17,000 copies of issue one. I made considerably more money off of that hardcover book, based solely on the fact that it was a direct market, which is what as a fan you should want, right? So, you know, like when Archie was doing their Kickstarter and everyone got upset about that, or like when Zach Braff was doing his movie on Kickstarter, or, you know, like people that actually have finances, people tend to get really annoyed by it. But the reality is you're getting the exact same thing that you would if he just made a movie on his own without Kickstarter. But more of the money is going directly to the people making it rather than you know, and that's why it's such a great model. Unfortunately, people still see it as like a charity thing, you know, and now, like a get rich quick thing.
Right. Now it's a quid pro quo system, you know, like you give me some money and you're going to get something in return. And, you know, the difference between doing something like that and getting just financial backers is, well, the financial backers are going to give you money up front, and then they want a return on their investment.
Right.
So if they all give you $100 and you get 50 backers and you get $5,000 to do your book, well, they're all going to probably want $125 back.
Right.
But if you get all the books printed up, there's no guarantee you're going to sell enough books to pay them back and make any money yourself for doing all the work.
Right.
You might make enough to just pay back your backers, and that's that. Whereas when you're doing through Kickstarter, you know you've already sold 100 books before you even go out and get it printed. You
exactly.
know, right. And also, I mean, if you're a fan of, if somebody's a fan of you, if somebody's a fan of another artist or whoever's doing a Kickstarter, they should also, this way you should feel more part of the process as well.
Of course.
You know, you're, because if you're a fan of Lee Weeks, let's say, you know, he got paid a flat rate to do so many pages for that current Marvel or DC book he's working on. And that's it. He gets paid, it gets published, it puts out. And then any profit that's made off of that just goes right back to Marvel. They don't give him more money because that book he worked on happened to sell 10,000 more copies than they thought it was going to. You know, that's it. You know, but this way, if he decided I wanted to do my own creator-owned book and put it out there, he gets more of the money back for doing this than, you know, and will make more of a profit if it sells better than, you know, just working for Marvel or DC. You know?
Right. And working for Marvel and DC is considerably less risky. You know,
there are
advantages. More people read your stuff. It's considerably less risky. You know that you have paying work for this amount of time. Whereas I felt pretty confident that Blast Furnace would get funded, but I've spent thousands of hours on this book.
Right.
And my goal of 15,000 makes me no money. That just covers all my printing and shipping.
Right.
The books out costs, right?
Yes.
So now that I'm starting to sell more than my goal, every sale still has its costs, but I'm starting to make some money for myself, which is paying me for the crazy amount of time I put into it. But the nice thing is that at the end, I'm going to have a print run of books that have been entirely paid for through pre-orders.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I sell a $20 book, I make $20. Which is, so it's like a long, you know, it's a long haul to like actually make a good, you know, decent living doing things this way.
Right.
It's very different than finishing your pages, turning in a voucher, and then getting a direct deposit, you know?
Yes.
So yeah, it's a little bit more risky and it's a lot more work. But you can make exactly what you want and you can give it directly to your fans, and have the fans be a part of the actual, creative process, which I think is really exciting.
Right. No. And again, if someone's a fan of you, they should want to support your work. It's not like, because people will buy books, specifically for an artist or a writer, but they're not getting, the only thing it might do is if it sells really well, it might have Marvel bring that person in again to do another book, you know?
Sure. And you can get royalties. Marvel and DC pay royalties based on a scale in terms of sales. So if you were drawing, you
know, sometimes,
but if you were drawing like a big event book, you're expecting that you're going to get more than just your page rate, you know, in the long haul.
I don't know.
I've done very little for Marvel, and I've always gotten checks since then for trade sales, which is kind of awesome,
interesting.
I think. I did some stuff on Original Sins.
Okay.
And those trades have been selling, and every once in a while Marvel sends me a little email with a little bit of money, and it's kind of awesome. So it's not like creator owned money, you know.
Right.
But it's something.
Well, I think Marvel's probably better at that than but see, one of the things that's been going on lately, I'm sure you're aware, is like now the movies and the TV shows are becoming real big and they're making boatloads of money. And the creators who've created some of these characters who are still around today really aren't making, they're not getting any kind of share in the profits on those things.
Sure.
You know, and DC's been pretty sketchy on how they're handling it. Like, though they might say that the character on the TV show is derived from the character in the comic book, because they made these couple slight changes for the TV show, so it's not the same character anymore.
Yeah,
and it's
I think everything has changed. You know, the whole media stuff is kind of new, and mm-hmm. the way the contracts were structured before is, I assume, was different. Anything that I've seen now is seems to be prepared or tries to be prepared for any eventuality in the future.
Yeah.
But that's and I think now, like, if I do something for Marvel or DC, like, I accept that's that. You know, it's not the big that's work for hire. It used to be back right. in the day, you didn't even get to keep your original art pages. You just sent them in, and they'd get photostated, and then they would just sit in a drawer somewhere at Marvel or DC.
Yeah, that is true.
So, I mean, that's always the great dilemma. Like, you can make a lot of more money per book you draw if you do it creator owned, if it's really successful. If it's not really successful, you can get in a lot of trouble and get totally wiped out. Whereas if you do work for Marvel DC, you'll make, you know, you can make good money. But you get a ton more eyeballs on it, which is why, you know, you see a lot of people, you know, like Jonathan Hickman writing for Marvel for a long time, building up an audience, and then his creator-owned stuff, the stuff that he owns, can immediately find an audience because people will jump from Marvel work over to his creator-owned stuff. There's a level of comfort and structure in being work for hire. But then, you know, when you do create your own stuff, it's more you're running your own small business,
right?
It can be really scary.
Yes, because not only do you need to know how to draw and write, you need to then know how to market yourself. You know how to reach out to people, get financial backers, and then do shipping and all the overhead costs. Yes,
and you have to do it while you have a full time job.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, the 10 issues I did of God Hates Astronauts was just completely life overwhelming in terms of the amount of work that was required, because mm-hmm. I was writing, drawing it, doing some of the coloring, doing some of the lettering, doing all the design for each issue. You know, an Image, you have to design your issue. They'll help you put it out, but you have to come with your logo, you have to do the front cover, back cover, inside cover, you know, text layout, all that kind of stuff, which is really awesome. And I have, you know, I worked as a graphic designer for like 3.5 years. I do a lot of that stuff, and I think it's really fun, but it's also a ton more work. And, you know, I'm at this point in my career right now where, like, I'm actually working on something for Marvel right now. And it's just like, look, I can just write it and draw it and just turn it in. And then someone else can worry about, you know, the layout of the issue. And because it's Marvel, I don't have to work as hard to promote it. You know, like, it's just that there's like this comfort level of, and then I'm going to get a check, you know, before it even comes out. Because when you work for Image, you get your check 2 months after the issue comes out.
Okay.
So it's crazy. It's really tough. And like with God Hates Astronauts, they wanted me to have 3 issues finished before they solicited it. And the solicits are, what, 3 months, 2 months ahead of time before the issue actually comes out? So
yes. Yeah, I believe it's 2 months.
So I did 3 issues, took me 3 months, and then two more months of waiting for previews till it actually comes out, and 2 months of after that when you actually get paid. So it was full time on doing God Hates Astronauts, and I had to wait seven months before I made any money on it.
Right.
Or you could work for Marvel and you could draw 20 pages and then they send you a check. You know, so
there's pros and cons on both sides.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So can we ask what you're working on for Marvel?
I was going to say.
I'm doing a story in Secret Wars 2. It's this humor book they're putting out, I think, in October.
Oh, okay.
And I'm creating an original character for it.
Uh-huh.
And I'm fine with the fact that I will no longer own that character.
Okay.
Because it's work for hire, and that's the way it goes.
You know? Now I'm intrigued.
Yeah,
I will be rushing out when that book hits the stores.
No, it's gonna be really awesome. I really can't believe that they let me do what I'm doing. So it's gonna be sweet.
All right.
Did it involve Stan Lee and a katana? I should pitch this to Marvel.
I want to make a comic called like 22 Stan Lees, and it's just a comic about every single character Stan Lee plays in all the Marvel movies, just kind of hanging out together, like mailman and security guard Stan Lee and whatever other, you know, hot dog vendor Stan Lee. I don't know. I don't remember all the guys he is, but I think that would be a really fun, you know, 12 issue maxi series of lots of Stan Lees.
That would be awesome.
John, you keep making references to that upcoming Marvel cover, and we never told the story online, so people don't know what you're talking about.
We didn't? I thought we did.
Oh, no, I haven't told the story online because I don't want to get certain parties in trouble.
Oh. And here I go with my big mouth again. This is why you pay me the big bucks.
Because
I
now,
tell you secrets.
Because yeah. Now if I tell the story, because the issue's, it's either out or it's going to be out soon. Soon as people see the, they'll know who we're talking about. So
okay.
So we're just going to leave it at that for right now. Maybe after this dust settles on it, we'll tell the story on air. I'm going to see this person the second weekend in October, so I'll talk to him about it then.
Man,
anyway,
so mysterious.
Yes. So I know we have to let you get going. You have to go play Dungeons and Dragons for people who like sports. And
no, because it's more. I mean, I guess there is a decent amount of math in Dungeons and Dragons.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Fantasy sports, you know, scratches my itch of math and statistics and that kind of stuff. I mean, and collecting. It's a lot about collecting, you know?
People.
Yeah, it's super nerdy. But for some reason, because the men are large and get hurt a lot, it's acceptable by people that say they're not into nerdy things.
Yes, yes, yeah. Exactly.
I'm a very bizarre outlier of a creative type who makes comics who love sports more than anything. So... and I'm constantly filled with inner guilt that I enjoy sports as much as I do.
Do you feel like you have to give yourself a wedgie every once in a while? It's just...
No, man.
Sports is just my proxy for war, you know? Like, I'm watching war every day.
All right.
There you go.
So, I guess before we let go, where's the best place people can find you online?
I really take a lot of pride in my Instagram account. It has a lot of pictures of my cat.
Yes.
who's pretty exceptional. So yeah, everything that I have on there is either something I think is funny or a process thing for a comic I'm working on. So I try to keep it pretty Spartan and fun. And that's at Ryan Brown Art, and Brown has an E on the end.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, that's the best place to and it's the same on Twitter at Ryan Brown Art. But, you know, I'd rather show you a funny picture than try and come up with something clever in 140 characters or whatever.
Yes, yes. You know, a picture says 1,000 words and 140 characters doesn't say much. And right. And then your Tumblr site too, right? It's
go to GodHatesAstronauts.com or RyanBrown.net, I think, also goes there.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool.
All right. And is there all right, so we know we're all going to keep an eye out for Secret Wars number 2 coming out in October. Mm-hmm. People are going to run out after listening to this and contribute to your Blast Furnace Kickstarter, which the link will be in the description of the episode.
Awesome.
And yeah, so if there's nothing else, as we say every week, boys and girls, don't let your cape be caught in the door. Have a good week.
Okay, now it's my turn. Okay, what are you doing? Taking over Dad's mic so I can be part of superhero speak. Duh.
Well, there are better ways to join the conversation.
Really? Like what?
Well, you can interact with them on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and even Pinterest.
Wait, people use Pinterest? And what's Google+?
I don't know, something to do with circles. Anyway, you can also see all their posts, including comic book reviews, on their website, where you can also sign up for their mailing list.
Cool! Yep. Are you still going to try to hijack Dad's mic?
Nope. I'm going to try to answer the Stump the Geek question.
Nice. So who do you think would win in a fight between Rainbow Dash and Squirrel Girl?
Oh, that's a hard one. Oh, no. Dad's waking up. My family's!
Oh. What are you guys doing? That cape's going to get caught in the door.
Ow.